This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Signs of economic recovery? Well, maybe for Wall Street and the banksters, but what about our street? Where's the beef? Where's the jobs?
The United States is still experiencing its worst jobs crisis since the Great Depression. The unemployment rate had been improving at a very slow, a painfully slow rate, but the most recent figures bring it back up to 9.1%. In 2009, there were 43.6 million people living in poverty, the largest figure in the 51 years for which poverty estimates are available, and the numbers have been climbing. The national crisis demands a bold plan to put people back to work.
And to prevent those wielding the axe from chopping more jobs and cutting further holes in the safety net and jeopardizing entitlement programs. We're joined by Avis Jones DeWeaver, Executive Director of the National Council of Negro Women, Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League and former Mayor of New Orleans, and Dean Baker, Co-Director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Avis, why don't we begin with yourself? Give us a breakdown of, let's say, the state of poverty within this country during the last period of time, really with the onset of the recession.
We are still reeling from the very substantial repercussions of the Great Recession. We have the highest level of poverty that we've seen in this nation ever since we've been recording those statistics. We have the highest level of food insecurity, just plain hunger in America, that we've seen since we've been recording those statistics. The unemployment rate is still extremely and disproportionately high in black and brown communities. Really, I would argue, well above recession levels, and actually in some areas I would call it very much depression levels of unemployment. It's been strong and stubborn unemployment issues that many Americans are facing all across this nation, and of course the repercussions are substantial, hitting everything from just the stability of homes, being able to have food to eat, to being able to just take care of your basic needs, and now being able to pay for gas to get back and forth for your daily needs. It's really a very substantial level of discomfort that many families are facing in America, and it's unfortunate that it seems that on Capitol Hill, the drumbeat seems to be about the debt load versus making sure that families themselves are able to make it in today's society. You know, it's been a very interesting impact when you look at how women have fared as a result of this recession. Certainly women are still disproportionately likely, and particularly women who are heading families on their own, are disproportionately likely to live in poverty, and that remains the case to this day. It's been interesting, though. The story behind the Great Recession has been one, though, that has said that men have been disproportionately impacted, and that is true, in that if you look at the jobs that were lost, they were jobs that were largely concentrated in male-dominated industries. But if you look behind those numbers, and you look not only by gender, but both by race and gender, you find that there are very different stories that women can tell you dependent upon their race. So, for example, while we've seen white women's labor force participation increase over the course of the Great Recession, particularly as white men's unemployment was going up there towards the beginning of the recession, we have seen black women lose a substantial share in terms of their labor force participation rate. Black women have traditionally had the highest labor force participation rate of any women in this country, and black women have been substantially hard hit by the Great Recession, which has been particularly hard on black families who rely on black women's incomes to make ends meet. So though some people might want to argue that this is a man's recession, I would say that not entirely. It is a recession that has hit women too, particularly women of color.
We also have Mark Morial, who is President and CEO of the National Urban League and former mayor, which gives him also a unique vantage point of New Orleans, and a very critical report that's put out yearly, and that is the National Urban League State of Black America 2010 Jobs Responding to the Crisis. And One of the things I'm most interested in is, pursuant to this report, how does the kind of poverty rate and the loss of jobs and income relate to the African-American communities? What is the reality? How does it affect people in the gut?
It's first of all, it's so great to be on. And both our 2010 and 2011 State of Black America reports focused on jobs. In 2010, it was responding to the crisis. In 2011, it was about jobs rebuilding America. And the crisis and the recession has made what was a bad situation when it comes to wealth disparities and poverty even worse. The job losses, the housing losses, and one thing the statistics don't adequately capture is that many of the people who have been reemployed during and since the recession has begun to abate just a little bit have done so in jobs that pay less and jobs with less benefits. So we don't know the full picture of how this recession is really going to impact wealth disparities between blacks and whites, between rich and poor in this country. Suffice it to say that the nation has been on a trend really for almost 25 to 30 years where the gap between the haves and the have-nots has indeed become greater. That is one side of the story. The other side of the story is that we've had more people who have had to rely on the government safety net, food stamps and unemployment benefits, other forms of government programs that then at any time since these programs, you take them combined, have indeed been in effect. This is a tough recession. We remain considerably passionate about the need for there to be targeted economic policies. We don't think we've seen the types of policies that could, in fact, abate this recession or abate it when it comes to urban communities and communities of color. We've got to give credit that steps have been taken to try to make things better, to turn things around. There's slow economic growth. But by and large, we've got what we would call a jobs light recovery, jobs being created, but not enough jobs to really, really confront the fact that you've got 13 million people out of work. So we encourage people who are interested in this subject matter to go to NUL.org or IamEmpowered.com. This year you can look at the entire State of Black America report. You can look at the report free online. You can't download it. You've got to purchase it in order to get a hard copy of the book. But you can read it, and it's a combination of both analysis, case studies, ideas for policy proposals to try to fix the problem, too.
And Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, I guess we're going to find out now why they call economics the dismal science. The talk in Washington is all about cutting the deficit. We don't hear much talk about doing anything to get the unemployment down. So how does this play out in terms of the misery that's happening right now? Will it get worse?
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of people in Washington, their plans are to make things much, much worse. I mean, I don't think that they're saying they're conscious of trying to make things worse, but that would be the impact of their policy.
I think we have a little person on the interview as well.
Well, the next generation should be concerned.
Whose child is?
That's my son.
We can hear him loud and clear. If he's going to join us, he should do it fully.
Okay, hold on one second.
Dean Hay.
Yeah. Take it away.
Anyhow, so it's kind of incredible. We, in effect, have birtherism in the budget debate. I mean, we have this totally absurd story that's gained widespread currency that somehow we have government spending out of control. And I'm just sorry, it's not true. You know, if you know arithmetic, the budget data is there. It's not true. We've had some increase in spending. It's almost all associated with the recession. The economy collapsed because we had the housing bubble collapse, which we should be beating people over the head with baseball bats because they were too damn dumb to see an $8 trillion housing bubble. It's amazing you could do that and still keep your job. But there they are. No one's lost their job because of it. And that was the increase in spending. And now we have all these birthers running around talking about out-of-control budget spending. Zero. That's a total mess. It's just like, you know, oh, where's President Obama's birth certificate? I mean, it makes as much sense. So they want to cut the deficits. And, you know, if you cut the deficits and when you're still in an economy as weak as this, that's a recipe for reducing demand, reducing employment. It's that simple. And it's kind of amazing that both political parties, there's President Obama saying the same thing as the Republicans, because he's so damn intimidated, he won't say what he knows to be true, that we need to have spending now to create jobs.
And in addition to that, the reductions themselves will cause pain, right?
Sure, because, I mean, the places they're talking about cutting spending are in areas where we provide services. This is to a large extent the federal level, but probably more importantly at the state level. Every state and local government in the country, with almost no exceptions, is facing a budget deficit. And unlike the federal government, the state and local governments are required to balance their budgets. So what do you do when you're in a state with, you know, a big budget deficit because of the recession? Not, again, it was, you know, I'm not going to say every state was responsible, but most of them were not profligate. So you're sitting there with a big budget deficit. Well, you could try to raise taxes, but that's not a good thing to do in a recession either. And, again, not very popular. So what do you have to do? You cut back education spending. You cut back spending on Medicare, other health care expenditures, things that are very badly needed right now. You know, this is really birther economics, and unfortunately both political parties seem to be largely playing that game.
Avis, in terms of your organization also, what is the response to this? I mean, you've delineated quite aggressively the increase in poverty, the diminution in wealth, the greater disparity. America is not broke. What begins to be the position on the fact that this still appears to be a jobless recovery?
Well, people are justifiably quite distressed, and I'm probably using much too light a word, that they can see that they are putting forth a tremendous amount of effort, particularly those who have been touched personally or by someone in their extended family with long bouts of unemployment, people who have lost their home due to foreclosure and have had their wealth literally obliterated. These individuals think, hey, I played by the rules. I did what I was supposed to do. I've worked on a hard job for years, and now all of a sudden I find myself out in the cold, yet I can't buy my way back into this economy despite trying to do everything that I was told I needed to do in order to prepare myself for this economy. You know, even people who have, you know, college degrees, graduate degrees, find themselves in situations where they might be one of those who's long-term unemployed or, as Mr. Muriel said, was able to find employment after a bout of unemployment, but for much, much reduced salaries than what they had. And so it's really a basis for much frustration. And it's very sad that every time they turn on the TV, I love that term, birther economics, because I think that's exactly right. Hit the nail on the head. Every time you turn on the television, this false crisis has been presented in terms of the deficit. To me, the real crisis is the fact that we have children going to bed hungry every night in America. The real crisis is that you have families now who will not be able to regain the wealth that they've lost for literally generations. That's the crisis that we need to be focused on in this nation. And unless we really are able to articulate that argument in terms of a political discourse that sort of changed the ball, in my opinion, he who dominates the parameters of the argument wins the argument. When you already acquiesce and say, okay, the main problem is that we have this deficit situation versus a situation where you have people who are woefully unemployed or underemployed, families who can't afford to drive back and forth to work every day. Once you start to look at those issues and say, this needs to be the center of our attention, I believe that there is a large groundswell of people out there who would be very, very interested in taking up that banner and leading that charge. It just requires a bit of political courage to be able to take that stand when it's so easy just to say, cut, cut, and let's do some more cuts.
Yeah, and I want to make a point because this is important. And, you know, the National Urban League, we've dedicated this year jobs, jobs, jobs. And we went to the extent of having our economic team, led by Dr. Bernard Anderson, to do an actual estimate of the number of jobs that would be lost if budget proposal, the compromise budget proposal, which they just agreed to, went through. And that number is 500,000 to 700,000. When you think about the federal budget, what has increased dramatically over the last decade in spending has been military spending. The Defense Department has seen a doubling in its budget. What's also increased is tax loopholes, so-called tax expenditures that are $1 trillion when you look at them in toto. So there's not only an intellectually disingenuous argument being made about the deficit being the biggest threat to the nation, but there's also an argument being made that seems to suggest that domestic spending, education, job training programs, community development programs are, in fact, the bulk of the budget and the bulk of the expenditure. So I am hoping that people who are interested in this issue on an ongoing basis will come and follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, follow our weekly communications where we're discussing these issues and put pushing back hard against these issues.
And Dean Baker, what else needs to be done, and what needs to be done to save the states so that the states don't have such cutbacks?
It would be great if there were a way to get more federal money to the states. I always am struck as watching in the financial crisis how we moved heaven and earth to make sure that Citigroup and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs stayed afloat, you know, probably broke the law in many cases to make sure they had the money to keep them going, made guarantees to them. The Fed itself was saying they're not sure the legal authority to do many things they did, but they did it, you know, and maybe that was good, maybe that was bad. But the point was they made sure that, you know, these huge financial institutions stayed in business. With the states, you know, it's sort of like, well, too bad for you. And we're telling these states to make cutbacks at a time when, you know, these services are desperately needed. So it would be great to get more funding to them. If that's not, you know, obviously the states can't determine what happens in Washington. Go where the money is. Go to Wall Street. Go to the financial industry. I was working on a piece the other day. You could tax the financial industry. This is actually something the International Monetary Fund, of all people, advocated.
Dick to my ears.
Yeah. You have financial activities tax. That's something they propose. There's a lot of waste, a lot of rents. That's where the money is. Tax these people. You know, who cares? What are they going to do? You know, they're going to go to Mars? You know, that's what they'll say. And, you know, these people will say the truth once in a blue moon. So that's a source where you could raise a lot of money. So, you know, rather than cutting back essential services or beating up on school teachers and firefighters, these are not usually people most of us think is overpaid. You know, if you're going to be a school teacher, you might be glad for them that they're going to be doing something productive. But I don't think many of us, if our kids tell us they're going to be a school teacher, think, wow, you're really going to be rich. You know, so it's a little perverse, the conversations we've been having lately.
And one of the things I was also interested in, Dean, is what you call the deficit of democracy. That was part of an article you did on the tyranny of the central banks, because there's an economic, but there's also a decision-making that is a usurpation, really, of democratic process.
One of the things that's amazing to me, and I understand I'm an economist, this is my area, but central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, has enormous control over the economy. And here it is, you'll get debates in Congress, and there'll be bills that will come up, some of them a few hundred million here or there, or a few billion. That's a lot of money to us, but it's not a lot of money to the economy. It doesn't have a big impact on the economy one way or the other. And there'll be this big debate on the Federal Reserve Board, by raising interest rates, being more aggressive in trying to create jobs, that swamps the impact that Congress has with 99.9% of the things it ever comes across. And yet most people don't have the foggiest clue about it. Here it is that these guys, there's some women there too, mostly men still, they're making these decisions largely out of the sight of the public. Many of the people who make the decisions were appointed literally by the banks. You have a group, the key decision-making body is the Open Market Committee with 19 members. 7 are appointed by the president, approved by Congress. The other 12 are essentially appointed by the banks. They're making these very fundamental decisions about the nation's economy. As I say, largely out of sight of the public, most people don't have a clue about it. And the banks, I say, imagine the unions got to appoint 12 of the 19. I mean, people go nuts. Like, where did the unions? Well, sorry, unions represent a hell of a lot more people than the banks.
Avis, Dr. King, when he started talking about economic issues in the late 60s, talked about a guaranteed annual wage. And the reason I'm bringing it up right now is that we're going to start having people falling off the unemployment compensation system like an avalanche fairly soon, especially at the end of this year when the extensions are up. Do you think we have to rethink this whole thing?
I think it's, well, you know, kind of harkening back to another push by Dr. King, I really think it's time for a poor people's movement. It's time for people to get together at the grassroots level who are suffering, but whose needs are not even being discussed in large part, except for talking about ways in which one can cut back in those areas that's specifically meant to help the poorest of the poor. Now, when you're having serious discussions about how you're going to cut SCHIP, nutrition programs for children, at a time when we have 1 in 5 children in this country who are poor and 1 in 4 African-American children or Latino children in this country who are poor, when you're actually having that as a real discussion on Capitol Hill, something's wrong with that picture. So I hear what you're saying in terms of making sure. I certainly believe that those individuals need to be protected. This is a recession that we have not seen in recent history. That's why it is the Great Recession. And so I do believe that movement needs to take place on Capitol Hill to make sure that those individuals aren't just abandoned at the end of that lengthy term on unemployment. However, beyond that, I think oftentimes in order to get politicians to do what they need to do, you need to make them do it. And you can't do that by being silent. You've got to do it by being organized and being noisy. And that's what needs to happen.
One of the things, Mark Morial, that I was thinking about, I kept waiting for somebody to say we've had a freeze on building rental housing since the Nixon years. And certainly I looked at the reality of the housing crisis post Katrina in New Orleans and all over the country. And yet there is not so much as a mumbling word about the duality of both needing rental housing, the freeze in dollars, and what it would mean to put people to work, not just putting in energy-efficient windows, but first they have to have the structures to put the glass into. And I'm interested in what some of the prescriptions are within the National Urban League's plan for creating jobs.
I tell you, you know, the big issue, the big idea that we promoted from the minute the president was elected as a part of the stimulus that didn't get included was direct job creation. A true public works program, like the Works Progress Administration, like the efforts with FEDA in the 1970s, that would have directly put people to work, working for cities, working for states, working for nonprofit organizations. That would have been the best way to create significant jobs in a short period of time. That was deemed not politically palatable. It is still the centerpiece of our economic plan and the centerpiece of our 12-point jobs plan, but the politics hasn't been there. The courage to push that hasn't been there, although there were some Democrats in the House who, in fact, introduced the bill, George Miller, John Conyers, that, in fact, would have done that. I'm glad you raised housing because there's an issue that is going on in housing circles that hasn't been as much discussed in the public, and that is this idea that's been floated to require a 20% down mortgage. And this issue of home ownership, not just rental housing, but home ownership and the availability of home ownership for communities of color, for urban communities, and for working people is really an issue that's playing out. There's a move afoot in many, many quarters of this country to suggest that we ought to cut back on home ownership because, quote unquote, providing home ownership opportunities to communities of color, the Community Reinvestment Act, in fact, created the housing bubble. I call it a weapon of mass deception because it's a big lie being foisted, but now you see it emerging in some of the new rules that are being written. One being that a qualified residential mortgage should require people to put 20% down. We're working today, literally today, Sunday, on a commentary, on a comment to that proposed rule, as many have been, to push back on it. So I think the whole question of housing, the need for not only more rental housing, but the need to provide home ownership opportunities going forward and to say to people it was not, quote, lending to black and Latinos that caused the housing crisis. It was the conduct of banks, the secondary market, all of those excesses, predatory lending that caused this bubble, that caused the crisis. And we've got to make sure that going forward, our voices are going to be there. What I've learned is that this, like the discussion about the Federal Reserve, involves highly complex discussions in closed circles of regulators and banks, where there are a handful of community-oriented groups that are involved. And so I think it might be a great subject for a future show to focus on housing and the new rules being proposed in the housing arena, some of which would really be damaging to urban communities and communities of color.
Dean Baker, you'll have the last word, but unfortunately it's going to have to be very brief. So just tell us one important thing that was not discussed today that you think is crucial.
Well, I'll tell you something. Almost no one talks about getting the value of the dollar down because we have a huge trade deficit, which is costing us millions of jobs, and the only way we're ever going to address that is to get the dollar down. Politicians don't like to talk about that, but that is something in principle under our control. And if you want to create jobs in a way that doesn't require a big budget deficit, that one's hard to beat in my view. If you have an overvalued dollar, what that means is, in effect, we're subsidizing imports 20-30%, and we're putting a tariff on our exports of the same amount. And that makes it really hard to compete. And they say there's a simple way. Get the dollar down and you got rid of the problem.
And that would also cut a lot of the debt we have to the rest of the world.
Well, we'd stop accumulating, and that's exactly right. You have a lot of people, I think it's frankly quite racist, they talk about the debt we owe to China in the context of the budget deficit. Well, it has nothing to do with the budget deficit. We borrow money from China because we have a trade deficit with China. So if they're concerned about us owing money to China, they should be yelling, get the dollar down. But you never hear them say that. In fact, I hear a lot of the budget deficit hawks yelling, if we don't get the deficit down, the dollar's going to fall. So I want to shake them, go, well, no, you actually should want the dollar to fall. You don't seem to know what you're talking about.
And one last word, is there a debt crisis, a deficit crisis right now in the federal government?
Well, I'll just tell you what the financial markets say. Absolutely not, or they wouldn't be lending the U.S. money long-term at 3.4% interest. That's much lower than the rate they charged when we had budget surpluses at the end of the 90s. It's totally invented.
How do we wean the American public, who has been so propagandized on the idea of debt, who seems to feel that the federal debt is analogous to overdrawing your checkbook in your house?
Well, it's not an easy story because you have so many people. They hear it constantly in the media. I think that you have to beat up the reporters who say this, the politicians who say this. They all pat themselves on the back for being real tough guys, saying, oh, we told people the tough truth. You know, I was on a panel the other day with Alan Simpson, the former senator who was heading the commission that Obama appointed on the debt. And, you know, he's saying, I'm going to tell people what they don't want to hear. Well, he's also telling people things that isn't true, you know, that this doesn't make sense. And, you know, we just have to find forms in which we could expose what they're saying as not being true. And, you know, the basic story, yes, we all understand we can't outspend our credit card at $1,000 every month. Pretty soon we end in trouble. But the U.S. government's not like that. The U.S. government actually has the responsibility to support the economy when you're in a situation like we are today where the private sector won't do it. It has nothing to do whether you like the government or not. You could hate the government, but the private sector is not going to generate the demand right now. It's too heavily indebted. And, you know, we could snap our fingers, blink our eyes, jump up and down, whatever we might want. It's still not going to create the demand from the private sector.
Well, I'd like to thank the four of you. Oh, somebody may say, what do you mean four? Well, Mark's young son, I think had his first interview.
I'm at the park, and he's over there playing a little basketball now, so he's good.
This stuff's going to affect him, too.
And I got my daughter here, too, and so I got my eye on both of them. And
thanks very much to Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League and former mayor of New Orleans, and Avis Jones DeWeva, Executive Director of the National Council of Negro Women, albeit for a rather bleak synopsis of where we're at. And to
she tells the truth.
Yes, indeed. But they all have suggestions of where we go from here and what is to be done. And Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.